Welcome to the deep dive. So imagine reading a terrifying, just groundbreaking novel about an alien apocalypse. Humanity is left in absolute ruins by a technologically superior force from Mars.
Right, just total devastation.
Exactly. We're completely helpless. But then, barely a month later, you pick up your local newspaper and you find a knockoff sequel. But in this version, a real-life tech billionaire, Thomas Edison to be exact, he builds this heavily armed space fleet, rallies the troops, and flies off to punch the Martians right in the mouth.
It's honestly essentially the birth of fan fiction, but driven by sheer existential panic, we couldn't sit with the vulnerability for even 6 weeks.
Yeah, we had to strike back immediately. So today you're joining us for an exploration into one of the most, I'd say, pervasive and thrilling, but also introspective tropes in all of science fiction, the alien invasion.
Oh, absolutely. It is a massive one.
It really is. But we aren't just here to talk about, laser beams and exploding monuments. We are looking at the anatomy of these stories. We want to understand what our deepest fears of extraterrestrial conquest actually reveal about us. Because when you strip away the flying saucers, these stories are rarely about the aliens.
Not at all. I mean, they act as this massive psychological mirror. If you track how the alien invasion story evolves over the decades, you're basically tracking a timeline of human anxiety. You can see exactly what society was terrified of at any given moment.
Okay, let's unpack this because we all know the benchmark, right? Whenever this topic comes up, everyone immediately points to H.G. Wells.
Oh, of course.
We all think of his 1898 novel, War of the Worlds. You've got those towering Martian tripods just laying waste to Victorian England with heat rays. And Wells always gets all the credit for putting interplanetary war on the map. But hold on, looking at the actual timeline of the genre we have here, he wasn't the first, was he?
He actually wasn't, which is, it's wild to think about given his massive influence on pop culture. I mean, Wells definitely popularized the concept of a first contact going horribly wrong. But if we go back just 6 years earlier, so to 1892, there's a much more obscure novel called The Germ Growers.
The Germ
Yeah, The
Growers.
Germ Growers. It was written by an Australian clergyman named Robert Potter. And honestly, I think it is infinitely more unsettling than giant mechanical tripods.
Wait, okay, stop. An Australian clergyman in 1892. How does a 19th century priest even conceptualize something like an alien invasion? What is the actual plot
Well,
there?
that's what makes it so brilliant and, deeply terrifying. In Potter's novel, the aliens don't show up in these massive warships blotting out the sun. They actually take human form.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they secretly infiltrate society and they begin developing a virulent disease. The goal is to wipe out the global population so they can just, take over the empty real estate.
Wait, so you're telling me decades before biological warfare or like sleeper cells were even a blip on the public's radar, this guy's writing a thriller about aliens using manufactured pandemics to clear us out.
Exactly. I mean, you have to remember the late 19th century is right when the germ theory of disease is finally becoming widely accepted by the public. People are just starting to realize that these invisible microscopic entities can kill you.
Right, they're just figuring out they need to wash their hands.
Exactly. So Potter took that cutting-edge, real-world scientific terror and he weaponized it into science fiction. It really proves that the fear of a silent biological infiltration has been with us just as long as the fear of an explosive military attack.
That is just fascinating. But it also brings us right back to that bizarre Thomas Edison story I mentioned at the top. Because we see the overt military attack in War of the Worlds, and people absolutely lose their minds. And then this unauthorized sequel, Edison's Conquest of Mars by Garrett Peace Service, it gets published in the Boston Post almost immediately, just 6 weeks later. Why? Why couldn't people just enjoy the scary story?
Well, because Wells hit a very raw nerve. I mean, think about the era we're talking about. European powers were at the absolute height of their own global colonization, aggressively expanding into other countries with superior technology. And Wells simply flipped the perspective. He basically asked Victorian England, "How would you like it if someone showed up here with tech you don't understand and treated you the exact way you treat the rest of the world?"
Oh, wow. So it's basically colonial karma.
Precisely. It is colonial karma. And it left readers feeling profoundly vulnerable. I mean, Wells didn't even let humans win the war. We were saved by Earth's microbes. We were totally helpless.
Yeah, just sitting ducks.
Right. And that level of helplessness was deeply uncomfortable for the reading public. So Surface writes this sequel where American ingenuity, led by a famous real-world inventor, takes the fight to Mars. It's a massive psychological defense mechanism.
It's society saying, no, we aren't the victims here. We are technologically superior and we are going to strike back.
Exactly.
It's just massive cultural projection. But let's follow that evolutionary timeline you mentioned earlier. If overt militaristic invasions, so the spaceships and the counterattacks, if those are tied to that Victorian era of colonization and early 20th century warfare, something massive shifts after World War II, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the atomic bomb changes everything.
Right. Because suddenly humanity possesses the power to completely annihilate itself.
Yeah.
Overt warfare now means mutually assured destruction. So the science fiction has to adapt, right? It can't just be about lasers and big explosions anymore.
And that's exactly why the trope evolves into the alien infiltration variation. We move from the explosive dread of War of the Worlds to the quiet, really insidious paranoia of the mid-20th century.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The invaders no longer blow up cities because, frankly, we were already terrified of doing that to ourselves.
Hmm.
Instead, the aliens take human form. They move freely through our society, completely undetected, taking control of government positions, military command, or even, you know, your own family.
So we go from an Independence Day style attack to invasion of the body snatchers or stuff like First Wave.
Hmm.
But looking at the logic here for a second, are these mid-century stories actually about extraterrestrials at all? Because to me, it sounds less like a fear of outer space and more like a fear that you can't even trust the guy mowing the lawn next door. It's like a cosmic game of Among Us.
I love that comparison. And that's exactly the dynamic. This era of science fiction is just a direct translation of 1950s Cold War anxieties. You had the Red Scare, McCarthyism, the House Un-American Activities Committee. The overwhelming terror wasn't just a nuclear winter. It was covert infiltration by communist agents.
So the alien is just a stand-in.
Right. The alien in these stories represents the ultimate ideological subversion. The enemy looks exactly like you, talks exactly like you, but is secretly working to destroy your way of life from the inside.
They steal your individuality and absorb you into a collective hive mind. I mean, the metaphor isn't exactly subtle when you frame it like that.
It's unsubtle at all.
Yeah.
But the psychological anxiety of infiltration is incredibly sticky. It survives long past the Cold War. You actually see it manifest today in things like the reptilian conspiracy theory.
Oh, man. The idea that covert, shape-shifting reptiles are secretly running global politics.
Right. We just swapped out Soviet spies for alien lizards. But the underlying mechanism is totally identical. It's the ultimate expression of feeling a total lack of control over your own society. When the world feels too complex or, you know, too hostile, it's psychologically easier to believe that malicious, inhuman infiltrators are pulling the strings.
That makes total sense. But I do want to push back on the idea that infiltration is always this malicious, terrifying thing. Because sometimes the alien walking among us is just a guy trying to get by. Think about Star Trek.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because before humans officially achieve warp drive and make contact, there's all this lore about Vulcans actually living on Earth in secret.
Yes. There's actually a great detail from the source material about this. No fewer than 6 Vulcans spend time passing as humans on Earth. And the way they pull it off is just brilliant in its simplicity.
I love this part. They don't use like fancy cloaking devices or shape-shifting biology. They literally just wear skull caps or get strategic comb-overs to hide their pointy ears.
Stick a beanie and a bad haircut.
Exactly. It's hilarious, but it completely subverts that whole Cold War paranoia thing.
Hmm.
They aren't sleeper agents waiting to soften up Earth's defenses for a military strike. They're just benign observers.
Or shipwreck survivors trying to blend in. It really highlights how the exact same narrative, mechanic aliens hiding in plain sight, can evoke absolute terror or a sense of shared, peaceful coexistence. It completely depends on what the author wants to say about human nature.
Right. Like, are we inherently suspicious of outsiders, or can we just share a coffee with a Vulcan in a beanie?
Exactly.
Which perfectly sets up the flip side of this entire genre, because not every alien invasion is about eating us, stealing our resources, or, you know, replacing the mayor. Sometimes they show up because they want to save us from ourselves. Here's where it gets really interesting. This is the beneficial alien invasion.
Right, the little gray or green man's burden, as it's sometimes called.
I always think of this trope like a stressed parent dealing with a toddler. Humanity is the toddler, and we are running around the living room holding a pair of extremely sharp scissors, usually meaning nuclear weapons.
That is a very apt metaphor.
The toddler doesn't understand the catastrophic danger, right? So the advanced alien has to step in, physically take the scissors away, and put the kid in a cosmic timeout for their own good.
That analogy hits the nail on the head. You see this heavily in the 1951 film The Day the Earth Stood Still. You have Klaatu and his massive robot, Gort, and they land in Washington, D.C., but they don't attack.
Right, they just deliver a message.
Exactly. Their message is essentially a massive ultimatum. They basically say, you are about to bring atomic weapons into space. Abandon your warlike ways and join the Interstellar Union peacefully, or we will vaporize your planet before you become a threat to everyone else.
So it's very much, we come in peace, but we brought a really, really big stick.
Exactly. It's peace through forced disarmament. You see similar themes in Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End or the film Arrival. There's a deeply paternalistic or maternalistic current running through these narratives. The alien invaders don't view us as cattle to be harvested. They view us as reckless students or equals who just need strict guidance.
They're cosmic chaperones. But, I mean, even then, taking the scissors away still makes the toddler cry. It's a massive loss of human autonomy. Even if the occupation is allegedly for our own survival, we're still being colonized by a superior force telling us how to live.
Which is why the framing of colonizing to civilize is so deeply uncomfortable. It shares a lot of DNA with hostile occupation. It's just dressed up in benevolence.
Okay, let's take that concept of colonization and completely flip the script. Because there is a variation of the invasion trope that I find to be the most devastating, and that is the invasion by humans. What if we are the terrifying existential threat?
This raises an important question, and it's where science fiction truly earns its keep as a tool for intense self-reflection. There is a classic 1954 short story by Frederick Brown called Sentry.
Oh, that's a great one.
It really is. It puts you directly in the boots of a soldier engaged in this brutal, muddy, just terrifying war against these horrific alien monsters. You feel the soldier's fear and their patriotism. But the gut punch twist at the very end reveals that the alien monsters are actually the native inhabitants of the planet. And the soldier we've been rooting for all along is a human.
Yeah, we are the invaders.
We are. It completely shatters your perspective. It forces you to realize that from the viewpoint of the rest of the universe, our endless expansion and extraction make us the monsters.
And we explore this constantly in our media, right? Look at Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles or Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. Even modern blockbusters like Avatar or that animated movie Planet 51.
Oh, Planet 51 is a great fun example of this.
Right. In every single one of those, humanity is the force arriving on extraterrestrial shores.
Mm.
We exploit the resources, we displace the native populations, and we bring mechanized war.
Because it's a direct critique of our own human history. The alien invasion trope is rarely about aliens. It is the ultimate psychological projection of humanity's own colonial guilt. When we look back at our own timeline, whenever a technologically advanced civilization arrived on the shores of a less advanced one, it was historically catastrophic for the locals.
We know exactly what we are capable of.
Right. So when we write stories about going to space, we just project that historical guilt onto a galactic scale. Avatar is basically just human imperial history playing out on Pandora with blue aliens. We fear an invasion because we are terrified that there is something out there that will treat us the exact same way we have treated our fellow humans.
It's a really sobering realization. We are basically just bracing for the karmic payback of our own history. Okay, so we've gone deep into the psychology here. We've explored the Victorian tripods, the Cold War infiltration, the paternalistic cosmic chaperones, and our deep-seated colonial guilt. But let's ground this for a second. Let's bring it back to reality.
Sure, let's do it.
So, what does this all mean? If you're at a cocktail party and someone starts genuinely worrying about an Independence Day-style mothership hovering over New York, what does the actual scientific community say about the odds of this happening?
Well, the scientific consensus provides a very stark and, frankly, uncinematic reality check to Hollywood.
But let's just think about the logic here. If an alien species had the technological capability to build ships that can traverse the vast, almost incomprehensible distances of interstellar space, why would they come here to steal our water or our minerals? I mean, it makes zero economic sense. That's like driving all the way across the country from New York to Los Angeles just to buy a gallon of milk.
Your logic is flawless, and it's exactly the argument made by the heavy hitters in astrophysics. Take Seth Shostak, the senior astronomer at the SETI Institute.
Okay.
He points out that an actual physical alien invasion of Earth is incredibly unlikely for precisely that reason.
Mm-hmm.
The economics of the universe just don't support it.
Because everything we have here is available everywhere else, right?
Exactly. Earth is not uniquely stocked with rare commodities. There is an absolute abundance of water, iron, and minerals on uninhabited asteroids and planets that don't have a pesky, heavily armed civilization living on them.
That makes total sense.
Furthermore, if a civilization possesses the sheer energy required for interstellar travel, they almost certainly possess the technology to simply synthesize whatever materials they need right at home.
It really bursts the bubble of human exceptionalism, doesn't it? We love to think our planet is this unique, glittering jewel that the whole galaxy is scheming to conquer. But from a purely elemental standpoint, we just aren't that special. We're a remarkably average rock.
We really are.
Yeah.
And pulling resources out of a planet's gravity well is terribly inefficient anyway. But Shostak makes an even more interesting point about the mechanics of contact, if it were to happen.
Oh, what's that?
Let's say an advanced civilization does decide to reach out. It almost certainly wouldn't be biological beings stepping out of a flying saucer.
So no little green men walking down a ramp?
Highly unlikely. Biological organisms are fragile. Right. They need life support, food, water, radiation shielding. Mm. Space is profoundly hostile to biology. Mm. If you're crossing the galaxy, sending machines makes infinitely more sense.
So we'd be looking at AI probes.
Yes. Highly durable, self-repairing robotics. But even then, David Morrison, he's the former director of space at NASA's Ames Research Center, he takes it a step further. He argues that first contact wouldn't even involve physical objects visiting our solar system at all.
Wait, really? What would it be then?
It would just be a radio communication.
A signal from the dark.
Just a signal, beamed across light years at the speed of light, no massive armadas blotting out the sun, no physical risk, no astronomical resource costs, just pure data.
So if we pull all of these threads together, we've been on quite a journey today. We started with the sheer physical dread of Martian tripods tearing apart cities, which was really just our anxiety about our own imperial vulnerability. Then we shifted into the quiet paranoia of the Cold War, where the terrifying alien was just the person sitting next to you on the bus. We looked at our deep desire for paternalistic alien guardians to save us from our own nuclear scissors. And of course, the heavy reality that when we look in the mirror, the most terrifying invaders in the universe might just be us.
It's quite the mirror.
It is. And finally, the actual physics of the universe tell us that an armada showing up to steal our water is practically impossible.
When you lay it out like that, it's clear these stories are a journey through our own psychology, disguised as space battles.
They really are. So the next time you sit down in a theater and the lights go down for a new alien invasion movie, try looking past the CGI explosions. Ask yourself, what contemporary human anxiety is this movie actually trying to process? What is the filmmaker really afraid of right now? Because if we circle back to the very premise of this deep dive, that beautiful, peaceful, starry night sky isn't a threat matrix holding hostile alien armadas.
No, the vastness of space is indifferent to us. The real threats and the real monsters are usually much closer to home.
Which is strangely comforting, but also deeply challenging. But, you know, because this is science fiction, there is always a but.
There is always a but. And I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building directly on what the astrophysicist said.
Okay, let's hear it.
If NASA and the SETI researchers are completely right, and an advanced civilization wouldn't bother visiting us in person because of the vast distances, if they would only send radio waves because it's safe and efficient,
yeah,
then what happens if we finally receive that radio signal and it isn't a greeting?
Yeah.
What if it's a desperate warning about an invasion from something else entirely?
Now that is a deep dive for another day.